have a lot to celebrate as we kick off 2019. We made The Nation Magazine's annual Progressive Honor Roll last month as Most Valuable Multimedia Maker for 2018. They noted that we produced essential media for our times, and actress and activist Jane Fonda seems to agree. To kick off the year, Jane is offering to match every dollar that listeners invest in the show, one-to-one. $10, $20, $100, $2. Give between now and the end of February, and you will be matched 100% by Jane Fonda. With Lily Tomlin, Jane is co-starring in the hit series Grace and Frankie on Netflix. Make a contribution of whatever size towards this pledge drive, and you're invited to a Season 5 watching party with us. Help us. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is the Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real models of shifting power from the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, politics, and activism. Are we going to hell or moving out from there? This week, Soulfire Farms' Leah Penniman talks with Chris Hedges, author of America, The Farewell Tour, about environmental threats, societal breakdown, and how we might come back together as humans. Then A Glimpse of Caged, a play written and conceived by Hedges' writing students in a high-security prison in New Jersey. That's all coming up on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. There is a familiar checklist for extinction, and we are ticking off every item on it, wrote one of our guests last year. The latest climate assessments warning of food shortages and mass die-offs seem to be recent ticks on that checklist. But the problems that plague us aren't only physical and economic and political, they seem to be spiritual. Resistance, that same author writes, is about becoming a complete human being. So how do we do that? With a new year upon us, a traditional time for beginning and connecting, I'm happy to have two people with me today who can help. Chris Hedges is the author I just quoted. His most recent book is America, The Farewell Tour. He's also a weekly columnist for Truthdig and hosts the Emmy Award-winning RT series On Contact. Leah Penniman is the co-director of Soulfire Farm, about which we have reported on this program, and the author of the new Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's practical guide to liberation on the land. Leah, Chris, thanks for coming in, and thanks for coming together. You know, I brought the two of you together because I'd interviewed each of you separately recently, and I just thought, gosh, I wish the two of you could just talk. But let's start with you, Chris, because let's start with what we're up against. And then let's talk about this work of connection that I think both of you actually know a lot about. Those climate assessments, the fourth one came in right after Thanksgiving when most people were paying no attention. I think the Trump administration released it at like 2 a.m. or something. It was pretty dire. What did it predict?
Well, they're all, I mean, the last four or five have been very dire, including the UN report and others. And the common theme of all of them is that the ecosystem is deteriorating at a rate that is far accelerated from what climate scientists had thought in the past. And of course, what they fear are feedback loops. And we know what feedback loops do because we've studied Venus, which used to have water and is now 800 degrees. And in essence, you know, for instance, you lose the polar ice caps. This exacerbates the rise in sea, the acidification. I mean, they feed off of each other and you lose control. And climate scientists have run studies which range from a 70% die-off of the human species to complete extinction. So, and the fact that we're not responding rationally, and I think a lot of it, and you can speak to this, is we are physically dislocated from the environment. I mean, it's one of the reasons I spend every summer and have in the White Mountains with my kids, because I want them to understand the power and, you know, even the sanctity of the natural world. So that what's happening and the deterioration, this form of ecocide, is not palpable for people who live in urban areas and survive off the corporate system of food distribution, trucking tomatoes, you know, all the way from California.
And yet your book, it does talk about the ecological threat. It also talks about the threat of war.
Right.
It talks about the threat of addiction. You do make a case that this isn't just an these aren't just external factors. There's something else going on.
Right. They're created by the rupturing of social bonds, what Durkheim, the sociologist, calls that anomie, that alienation, inability in the corporate state to self-actualize, to find a place, to have dignity and meaning in your life. And of course, the whole cult of the self, which lies at the core of commercial society or consumer society, is a recipe for anxiety and self-destruction, because the attainment of a particular product or an experience for money is just the starting point for further desires, which they know very well. So again, I mean, it's part of the reason I shut myself off. I'm not on any social media. I try to build as many walls as I can. You've probably built them more successfully because I find the common culture or the vernacular of the culture, especially as it is disseminated now through handheld devices, to be very detrimental to our emotional and our spiritual health.
Your farm is called Soul Fire Farm. Soul is the first word. Talk about how you intersect with what you're just hearing.
The cult of the self. It makes me think about some of my first farming teachers were women in Ghana back when I was 19, 20 years old. I lived for several months. And they pulled me aside one day and said, Manye Amidede, which is my name there, is it really true that in the United States people plant a seed and they do not pray, they do not sing, they do not pour any libation, make any offering, or even say thank you, and they expect a harvest? And ashamed, I had to admit that that was the pervasive practice, of course, here in the United States. And they said to me, no wonder you're sick. Right? And I think that speaks to what you're talking about, that when we treat the earth only as a material thing, and our interactions with her and with one another as transactional, it diminishes our souls. So Soul Fire Farm was created certainly, you know, with the mission to end racism and injustice in the food system, and part of that is about policy and resources and land redistribution. But another part of that is about healing from trauma and decolonizing ourselves, re-indigenizing our relationships with one another and with the natural world.
So these are two very different directions of the narrative. I mean, talk about Ghana, it's like the obliteration of a people through slavery and the healing from that casts a very different light on history. It's like it's moving from obliteration, perhaps somewhere better, than the version that I'm hearing from you, Chris, which is we have self-destructed. So is this a racial difference? Is it a gender difference? Is it just a choice to how
you
look at
things? Well, no, I mean, we have self-destructed, and all you have to do is look at what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, these deindustrialized zones that have been turned into quasi-police states where lethal force is delivered indiscriminately to unarmed people, mostly people of color. I teach in a prison. The whole system of mass incarceration is, I think I would argue, the most important civil rights issue of our time. It is a form of social control. 2.3 million, we have 25% of the world's prison population. So what we've done is taken a segment of the population, and in particular people of color, left them on the streets where they're forced largely into an illegal economy, so that we're in essence criminalizing poverty and then funneling them into a prison system. And I think really it comes down to that commodification of everything, the natural world and human life. And so these black and brown bodies cannot generate an income for corporate power on the streets of our cities, but if you put them in a cage, they generate $50,000 or $60,000 a year, and having spent now over a decade teaching in the prison system, people say the system doesn't work. And I say, no, no, the system works just the way it was designed to work.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. My guests today are Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges and Leah Penniman, co-director of Soul Fire Farm in upstate New York. Each of these two came on the program recently to discuss their latest book. You'll find those interviews and more in our archives at lauraflanders.org, where you can also watch this show and subscribe to our podcast. But I decided an interview with each of them individually wasn't enough. So today I brought them on together in a conversation that epitomizes, I think, the sort of unusual movement mashup you hear on The Laura Flanders Show. For those who are coming to the program fresh over the Pacifica Radio Network and its fine affiliate community radio stations, welcome. This is the place where, as we say, the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. And if this show is not airing on a station near you yet, we hope that you will not take a back seat, but ask them to add us today. It is free and easy, and you'll be helping us to reach the goal we just set of doubling the number of places that are playing the show in the next 12 months. Later on, you'll hear about Caged, Life Beyond Bars, a play written and conceived by Chris Hedges' writing students in a high-security prison in New Jersey. And after the break, ever the optimist, I asked Penniman and Hedges whether their trail of crumbs could be possibly taking us from extremely bad to a little bit better, even as society seems to be crumbling. But first, here's Thievery Corporation from their album Babylon Falling, featuring Puma, released on 18th Street Lounge Records.
Poison intelligence, any way you choose to explore. And you've been like a pestilence ever since you reached the shore. The root of evil is your motivation, and of this I am sure. And even how you misguide all the nations, even more than before. Babylon falling, falling down. Babylon falling, falling, falling down.
Many days I wake up thinking, oh, we're going from bad to worse. Then there are the days that I come to do this program, which is all about finding models of change and lifting up models of change, where I come away at the end of the day thinking, well, maybe we're going from bad to a little bit better. Maybe there are crumbs that we can follow to take us on a different path. And you're one of those crumbs, so speak up.
Hopefully we're more than crumbs, right? Well, I don't know about the arc, you know, of bad to worse or good to bad, and I certainly don't think our people were ever obliterated. I mean, we've been up against a lot. The transatlantic slave trade was no joke. Enslavement, bondage slavery was no joke. And the whole criminal injustice system and mass incarceration is very linked in with the food system. You know, in 1865, with the Emancipation Proclamation, there's the loophole. You can still be enslaved if convicted of a crime. So the prisons fill in 1866 with black people. Not because folks were raping and pillaging, but because new laws were on the books called the Black Codes. Vagrancy, loitering, truancy, being not upright and honest. That gets you in jail, and then you're leased back to the plantation. You're leased back to the mines. You know, Alabama had 73% of its state budget coming from convict leasing in the late 1860s. And that black youth in our community are still picked up for those same non-crimes, hanging around, not having a job.
No, my favorite is obstructing, I'm not making this up, obstructing pedestrian traffic. Mm-hmm. That means standing on a sidewalk.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Because, you know, as corporations don't pay taxes, you take poor counties like St. Louis County, they depend on 30 or 40% of their revenues from fines. That was part of the impetus behind Ferguson.
I think of sort of the paradox of evil, and sometimes I think of kind of the miracle of good. I mean, it's kind of miraculous that we figure out how to keep going anyway.
And we do. And one of the places where our work intersects is for many years we were doing something called Youth Grow Up Program with Albany County Department of Corrections, where we had a deal, essentially, that young people could, if they were convicted of minor crimes, you know, could come to our farm, do a 50-hour leadership program, and then be absolved. You know, their record would be wiped clean. And when we talked to these young people who'd come out to the farm, by and large, you know, they were in for non-crimes, truancy, sort of getting out of control. But what was really powerful, you know, not to be trite about it, we're on a farm, and of course the first thought is slavery and all this stuff, But for young folks who are told that the only future for them is incarceration or early death or corporate conformity, they look around, they're like, y'all seem really cool. You own this land, you built your house, these are your kids and they're happy, and you're sort of in charge of your own destiny. And these windows start opening up in terms of what is possible for my future. We had this one amazing young man, Dejor Carter, who came very, very skeptical. He's like, this is better than jail, but not much, right? And he did not want to get out of the van. But then when we all started going on a tour, he was afraid that a bear would eat him. So he got out of the van. He didn't want to be left alone in the woods, you know? And it's muddy. It's muddy on the land. Didn't want to ruin his sneakers. And so I said, well, you can ruin your sneakers or you can take them off. So he took off his shoes. All these young men take off their shoes. They're squealing. There's worms. There's bugs, you know. By the end of the tour, where they weren't listening to anything, we sat down. He said, you know, miss, this sounds really strange, but when I touched my bare foot on the earth, a memory of my grandmother came up through my foot and came to my heart. And when I was really little before she passed away, you know, she used to garden with me and she put insects in my hand. And miss, I didn't think I had anything to do with this place, or this place had anything to do with me, but it does. It really does have something to do with me. And it's moments like those. They're not very quantifiable, but it's a window into a different possibility, a different picture.
That's
of sovereignty.
That's right, because it's about transcendence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do come out of a religious tradition. I come out of Calvin. I have a very dark view of human nature. And people ask about hope, and hope is, it's not, it's bound in the experience of that moment that you just described, but it's bound in not, in the ineffable, in what is not necessarily practical. So one of my students, one of my best students, went into prison at 14, tried as an adult for crime. I'm 100% certain he did not commit. He's not eligible to go before a parole board until he is 70 years old. He's now 39. Mm. And my last class, he waits till everyone leaves. The bell goes, you got to move quick or you get a charge. He waits behind. He was my only A plus in the class. And he said, I know I'm going to die in this prison, but I work as hard as I do because one day I'm going to be a teacher like you. And he walks out. That's what keeps me going. You know, and maybe in some ways we only change the world one person at a time. You know, for me it's about the struggle, and I think we look back on African-American history and the long struggle and the current struggle, the utter failure, and Baldwin wrote about this endlessly, on the part of white America to acknowledge their crimes and give African-Americans the reparations that is long overdue. I, you know, when you read the great, like Richard Wright and the great writers, Ann Baldwin, I mean, Richard Wright at one point, you know, he said the songs, our work chants, our spirituals, that's what we had in place of freedom. And in fact, I think it's a much more sophisticated understanding of the nature of evil and the capacity for resistance and the building of community.
Which is why you spend a lot of time singing. There's a lot of singing and joy and dancing on the farm.
There is, because there's a lot of trauma that we have generally, but particularly related to the lands. You know, we certainly have thousands of years of noble, proud, dignified history on the land as African heritage people. We came up with a lot of crops, a lot of techniques, you know, and then post-slavery, the land became the scene of the crime, as Chris Bolden-Newsom would say. And so there is not a black person who comes to the farm whose first association is not enslavement or sharecropping. I don't stoop, I don't get dirty, I don't touch bugs. We left that behind in the red clays of Georgia when we went for the Great Migration, you know. And so part of what we realized we need to do, because I do believe the land is a source of healing as well as a source of material sustenance, is to directly address that trauma. And we use our Afro-Indigenous technologies to do that. And those are our songs, our music, our spiritual baths, our traditional religions. So our programs look like, you know, a soil class on cat eye and exchange capacity and how to interpret a soil test and your right cover crops for the season. And then we're going to head over to the pond and we're going to do ceremony. We're going to call our ancestors. We're going to ask for healing and offer healing to them. And it's been really profound. I didn't think there would be this overwhelming interest, but we have a wait list 2 years long for these programs. Like, our people are just clamoring to return to who we're meant to be.
That's what August Wilson captured in Joe Turner Come and Gone. You know, and he said, I mean, the play, which is set in Pittsburgh, 1910, but he talks about finding your song. That's what Byron Walker tells them.
And he talks about we are a land-based agrarian people, and when we left Georgia, we left a piece of our souls behind. Yeah. He talks about that.
There's two questions, and I have like 2 minutes left. One has to do with, is there a role for government in all of this? Because I think a lot of what we discover, what we talk about in terms of healing feels very individual to me, and while that's important, we have bigger structures that help us shift power. But the second part is, how do we address the zero-sum thinking that has been so embedded in American and in Western capitalist cultures, that if you get yours, I'll lose mine. And that is clearly what is fueling a lot of people to support the maniacs of the Trump administration and others. That sense of someone else's joy is my loss, is taking from me.
Well, I think the Trump, you know, that 40% of largely white and particularly male America, they've been dispossessed, as all of the working class has been dispossessed. But as Baldwin pointed out in one of his essays, African American men, as a general rule, don't tend to go through a midlife crisis because African Americans are much more cognizant of the fact that the system's rigged against them. White men are far more susceptible to the myth. And, of course, now that myth has collapsed completely. And so they stoke that sense of vengeance, that scapegoating. You know, you are suffering because the other. I mean, the whole idea that undocumented workers are responsible for the economic collapse is, of course, you know, insane. These people don't even earn minimum wage. 11 million, whatever they are, people didn't destroy the economy. So I think that it's as Baldwin pointed out, it's more a sense that what they expected, what they thought was their right, especially as white men, was not given to them. And so they are reacting with this inchoate, irrational, violent behavior that replicates exactly what I saw in Yugoslavia, by the way, with the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia.
So I think, tell them to take off their shoes? I mean, what... How did we reconnect?
No, I think that the only hope is to reintegrate to people in the society, to rebuild the social bonds that can mitigate this rage. In many ways, the rage is legitimate, but of course, the target isn't. But in Yugoslavia, with the war that I covered, going back to Weimar, I mean, they always will find that particular scapegoat, and traditionally, people of color, intellectuals, homosexuals, I mean, it's the list remains the same. And Jews, I mean, Israel's Jewish support for Trump is insane because Jews are on the list.
Well, it's certainly not individual or government. I do think that, you know, individual transformation then catalyzes institutional and societal transformation. So we still need to deal with the fact that the labor laws in this country don't give fair treatment to agricultural workers or food workers. We need to deal with the fact that we have a very unjust immigration policy, that land is almost entirely controlled by white folks in this country. So there's a lot of policies that need to change, and we work very hard on those. You know, these youth that I was talking about that come to the farm, they didn't just take off their shoes and feel good. They wrote a list of demands that were then championed by a number of nonprofit organizations working on prison reform and criminal justice reform. So both things need to happen. But I do believe, you know, I do want to change policy and force social justice, essentially. I don't think we didn't want to wait till every plantation owner changed their mind about slavery. We wanted to go ahead and pass an amendment. But that long-term change does come down to individual relationships. When we talk about zero sum, it makes me think of this one neighbor we have, Phil, who waves a Blue Lives Matter flag and a big Trump sign. And I ran into him at the Grafton Peace Pagoda, which is where a Japanese Buddhist peace monk like leads these really radical marches and stuff. And he's fixing her driveway because we just had some flooding. And so it's really incongruous. And I ask him, Phil, what are you doing? He's like, oh, you know, neighbors help neighbors and so on. And he said, did that climate change thing, that might be a thing. You know, I was always told it's not really a thing, but that might be a thing. We've had a lot of flooding. And I said, so tell me about your flag that you fly, the Blue Lives Matter flag. And he said, oh, my uncle's a cop. I said, you know that's an anti-Black Lives Matter? Oh, no, I didn't know that. You know, and so in this interaction, in this relationship with Phil, which is very humanized, you know, we hire him to fix our driveway too, there's a breaking down of those imaginary barriers between it has to be me winning or you winning, and an understanding of where the other person is coming from.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. That was Leah Penniman of Soulfire Farm and the author of Farming While Black, Soulfire's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land. With Leah, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, author most recently of America, the Farewell Tour. You can find Hedges on RT, where he hosts his own show, On Contact. My longer conversations with each of today's guests, one-on-one, are freely available to podcast subscribers in our archives, which you'll find at www.lauraflanders.org. Next, Caged, Life Beyond Bars. It's a play written and conceived by Chris Hedges' writing students in a high-security prison in New Jersey. The clip we're about to play starts with one of Chris's students, Boris Franklin, who is no longer incarcerated, talking about what it took to bring Caged to the stage.
I have a firm belief that if individuals actually knew what was going on, then they would move with a sense of urgency to do something about this problem, because it is, in fact, a problem.
Hi, I'm Chris Hedges, and I taught a drama course in East Jersey State Prison a couple years ago. And during that course, we read August Wilson, Amira Baraka, and I proposed that first week that my students write scenes from their life.
And I remember that first week I came home with 28 scenes, and it blew my mind. I had five or six incredibly talented writers that became the engine for this remarkable play that we ended up finishing in December called Caged.
When you ask how many have got out besides me, I'm the only one who's gotten out of prison. He said, well, I want to put together a play in this class. You have 28 people. He said, what I want to do is I want to take the strongest writers, I want to bring them together to work on it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it in half, and I'm going to have half of the class right from the inside and half of the class right from the outside.
It's a play that speaks the truth about the horrors of mass incarceration and neo-slavery. It's a truth we don't hear very much, and it's a painful truth.
I'm June Ballinger, and I'm the artistic director of Passage Theater in Trenton, New Jersey. And we have taken on the responsibility of putting this play on the stage.
This is what they wrote for the dedication of their play. We have been buried alive behind these walls for years, often decades. Most of the outside world has abandoned us, but a few friends and family have never forgotten that we are human beings and worthy of life. It is to them, our saints, that we dedicate this play.
In my hands, I held their story. I held their song, as Byram Walker says in Joe Turner Come and Gone. And they're in cages, and I wasn't. And when I walked out of that prison holding their song into that darkened parking lot, I knew that it was my task to make their song heard.
Mass incarceration started when, in the 80s? 70s, 80s? Now we're just having the conversation.
That was just a taste of Caged, Life Beyond Bars, a play about mass incarceration written and conceived by men in a high-security prison. You can find out more about Chris Hedges and all our guests at lauraflanders.org, where you can also watch this week's show and see a short video on Caged, as well as clips of Soulfire Farm, What's It Look Like? Our recent interview with Leah Penniman is in the episode titled Food Justice is About Everything We Do. Our most recent interview with Chris Hedges is in the episode titled Hallelujah Farewell. Prefer to listen? Simply subscribe to this podcast. And please, if you use Apple products, write us a review. It really does help us spread the word. We have a lot to celebrate as we kick off 2019. We made The Nation magazine's annual Progressive Honor Roll last month as Most Valuable Multimedia Maker for 2018. They noted that we produced essential media for our times, and actress and activist Jane Fonda seems to agree. To kick off the year, Jane is offering to match every dollar that listeners invest in the show one-to-one. $10, $20, $100, $2. Give between now and the end of February, and you will be matched 100% by Jane Fonda. With Lily Tomlin, Jane is co-starring in the hit series Grace and Frankie on Netflix. Make a contribution of whatever size towards this pledge drive, and you're invited to a Season 5 watching party with us. As of this recording, we are just under $7,000 short of our goal. Will you do your bit? We are trying to match $25,000 by the end of this week. help us. Next week, if private bankers rigged the world, can public ownership unrig it? Researcher Thomas Hanna and former Goldman Sachs director Nomi Prinz will join me in studio. The show's produced by yours truly, along with Stephen Martinez-Partida, Monica Mohapatra, Donica D'Souza, Charlotte Carpenter, Jeannie Hopper, Joanna Pinto, and Dominic Marcella. The Laura Flanders Show is made possible with support from the Novo Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Fonda Foundation, the Tomcat Foundation, the Cloud Mountain Foundation, and listeners like you. Special thanks to Kim Connor, Lori Arbeiter, Jen Hobbs, and Chris Argatis. Stay kind, stay curious. Until next time, I'm Laura Flanders.